Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Thank you for being here. So we have convened this largely around ME's book about the abolition. So I'm introducing mostly ME here. So I have a little tribute and some framing and some motivating, after which I'll hand over to Nirman and then Emmy will speak next. So I just wanted to contextualize, you know, this panel a little. It's almost 6 years now that Emmy and I have been learning with and from one another about revolutionary feminism, queer and maroon history, critical utopianism, and abolition of the family. We've taught together, and we've taught each other's texts. We've somewhat lost track at times of the original boundaries between each of our research findings, the spaces, if there are any, between our respective political positions on some of these things. And our agnostic orientations on certain questions have dreams of future communism. And last year at this conference, I had the honor of discussing, and it might even have been in this room, ME and Iman's jointly authored work on speculative fiction, which Rachel already introduced, Everything for Everyone, which is an oral history of the future and an extraordinary ethnography of the way in which capitalism falls in New York City. I can't recommend that book enough. It really makes you think about your own communities, the parts of your city that would fight first and last, and on the wrong side, potentially. In any case, that's not what we're here today to discuss. So one of the greatest strengths, however, of ME and Iman's perspective for me is their deep attention to trauma, something I know ME refines in her practice as a psychoanalyst and an editor at Parapraxis magazine, which has sold out its second and third
First and second issues.
Thank you. This is an artifact of the highly in demand Parapraxis magazine you need to touch at the front.
They're for sale.
They're for sale. To the highest bidder. And the people who are sort of quote unquote interviewed in Everything for Everyone by much older versions of Iman and Emmy are hurt, fucked up people, human beings who have been experiencing both new traumas and a kind of deep healing process as they participate in mass struggle. And the healing, such as it is, will take a lot more time. And perhaps the only thing that can fully, if we want to use that word, which perhaps has some problems, but heal fully, perhaps is a large-scale insurgency, right? In her capacity as an editor at Pinko magazine, Emmy has been involved in a project about accountability, interviewing a number of activists about what happens following sexual and other forms of interpersonal harm and abuse. This is also a topic she meditates on towards the end of this phenomenal new book, Family Abolition, Capitalism and the Communizing of Care, which you should buy today. And the ins and outs of restorative and transformative justice in, against, and beyond the family is a topic I yearn to see deepened in our ecologies of struggle. It also, I think, naturally, inevitably makes me anxious the way all truly revolutionary projects perhaps must make us anxious, since abolition necessarily includes, in some capacity, an element of self-abolition. Our mutual friend Scott Branson is a serious thinker of the breakup and of intimate relationships as a site of struggle. So there's another Pinko sort of author to look out for, and a podcast called Breakup Theory, which I'm thinking of in relation to all of these questions. We're here too to talk about family abolition a bit more abstractly, as a mass historic, infrastructural, and large-scale process of communization, right? I sometimes lean almost too heavily in this direction because, you know, magazine editors want to know 7 steps to abolish the family at home. So I say, no. It's all architecture and mass kitchens and mass, you know, systems and provision. But, you know, neither of those poles is quite right. So how did this topic find its way back into the left after decades of lying dormant? In 2015, 2 friends of ours, Jules Joanne Gleason and Cade Doyle Griffiths, wrote a short proposal for what they called a non-dyadic creche, or a sort of counter-social institution that would concretely advance the abolition of the private nuclear household, which is the same thing as the family, within the context of wider revolutionary transformation. And then people started joining that small sort of Western Marxist, transgender Marxist revival. And another thinker dear to us, Madeline Lane McKinley, began publishing essays, poetry chapbooks on the subject of family abolition for kids, sometimes in the form of letters to their child. She puts this in the context of No Borders militancy and a critique of the construction of innocence in childhood, which again we're going to be discussing tomorrow with Jules Gill Peterson. And I've gathered together a syllabus on children's liberation, which I teach at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research in the presence of some of the people in this room. When my mother died not so long ago, I started thinking about the thwarted potential of the idea of the mom raid, and this relationship helped me think about the poverty of all care, even supposedly good care, in the context of capitalism. And I've been trying to think with people who are grief doulas and involved in abolishing family policing, around these sorts of questions of what I call mothering against motherhood. Well, it's not meaningful in that. It was Adrienne Rich originally. But now I'm thinking of it in terms of the revolutionary mothering of people like Alexis Pauline Gunns. So this is, a mothering against the patriarchal institution of motherhood, which deploys a sort of healing and a holding in conscious and direct rejection of notions of property. So I've defended this premise as well further back in Full Surrogacy Now, saying the labor of mothering has no innate or immovable gender, and is a labor that can be taken up collectively, especially in the context of the protest kitchen or the insurgent encampment, by any number of sort of quote-unquote motherers, if you want, to slightly denaturalize the baggage of the term mother. I just add another ER, motherer, I'm just going to now read 2 paragraphs from my little Abolish the Family book, and then say a little bit more about one particular aspect of Emmy's approach to communization and care that I find particularly interesting. I hope that's okay.
Of course.
This is part of the chapter on Black kinship in North America, the ungendering of Blackness, and the framing in my little book of family abolition as a decolonialist and anti-racist problematic. It's part of my overarching defense of the terminology of abolition, right? Rather than the other words that people would often prefer. It's a chapter called Abolish Witch Family. So this is just a small framing set of remarks. The debate between family, quote-unquote, reform or expansion and family abolition is not a mere semantic quibble, as Michelle Barrett and Mary McIntosh observed in 1982. While we might not have all the answers right away, ultimately, quote, it will be important to determine whether the positive ideals and satisfactions that we hope to strengthen spring from the family or, as we shall argue, in spite of it, unquote. And all of this is such maximally difficult political terrain. If the family is a combined and uneven form of thriving denied to some, while being a combined and uneven mechanism of violence, concentrating power in the hands of others, it's perhaps foolish to imagine that we could find an interpolitical strategy or a set of words that we could safely choose that would be adequate to the magnitude of the problem that is the family. One option is to specify, when we talk about abolition of the family, that we mean the white, cis-heteropatriarchal, nuclear, colonial family, and this might feel safer, but might actually pose more dangers in its invitation to excuse or romanticize the political character of all non-white, mixed, gay, and or indigenous homes, while neglecting most people's family abolitionist needs and excluding them, in a sense, from family abolitionist politics. Another option is to cleave to the infinitely harder line and say that for historical reasons, no other family than this family kind of exists, in a sense. Obviously, non-white households represent a planetary majority. Many families aren't straight, nor even cissexual, nor part of a program of colonizing settlement. But while whiteness and empire and heterosex have lots to do with the family's most fundamental feature, as Kathy Weeks insists, and I agree, is that it privatizes care. And that process of enclosure is one in which all private households unintentionally participate. So if we plump for this second option, the family is to be abolished even when it is aspired to, mythologized, valued, and in a sense embodied aspirationally by people who are neither white nor heterosexual, neither bourgeois nor colonizers. And this latter position is a position I believe to be correct. While there is no equality or justice in the distribution of what some call kinfulness between humans on this earth, and while there's no sense in which white, straight, and or bourgeois people deserve to reap the rewards of everyone else's courage in abolishing the family, it is yet only in collectively letting go of this technology of privatization, the family, that our species will truly prosper. Okay. Back to the concrete. Where are some of the sites where proletarians have begun to deprivatize care? In her 2019 essay, Junkie Communism, in Commune magazine, ME recounts how 50 years ago, the Black Panthers and the Young Lords seized a section of Lincoln Hospital in New York, establishing the first drug detox program at the center of the city's heroin epidemic. And this was shortly before, as I also talk about in Abolish the Family, the street transvestite action revolutionaries created their own transgenerational home, especially for refugees from the private heteronuclear household. A heterotopic and politicized commune, you know, not a perfect one, sustained by its members through both shoplifting and sex work. In Junkie Communism, ME links the Lincoln Hospital offensive, both explicitly and implicitly, to myriad other modes of advancing the communization of care, including sex worker liberation, anti-psychiatry, and her own first-hand experience at a syringe exchange in the South Bronx. You probably know that syringe exchange programs were established all across North America in the late 80s by activists, combating the devastation of AIDS. Heroin users were dying of AIDS at devastating rates, and clean syringes saved lives far more effectively than any other intervention. ME was passionately involved in the liberation struggle in and against AIDS, and she indeed had experiences of social movement milieus all around the world, as she recounts rather beautifully in chapter 12 of Family Abolition. And it was in my hometown, my current hometown, I don't sound like it's my hometown, but it is, of Philadelphia, that she fully internalized the politics of harm reduction, which she says means learning, quote, to care for each other with dignity and to challenge our capacity for harm by lovingly welcoming the most painful parts of ourselves, unquote. When refusing their imposed disposability and isolation through revolutionary activity, junkies and their friends move towards a communism not based on the dignity of work, but on the unconditional value of our lives. Our revolutionary politics must embrace the many broken and miserable places inside ourselves. It's from these places of pain that our fiercest revolutionary potential emerges. We need a communist politics that welcomes us all and encourages us fully as whatever we are, as freaks and fuck-ups, as faggots and trannies, as wreckers and miserable wrecks, as addicts and crazies. We need a junkie communism, writes ME.
I'm going to stand up because of the people sitting here who I can't see when I sit there. So I'm Emmy O'Brien. Pinko is co-sponsoring the panel, so I want to. We have a brand new book called After Accountability. It's a collection of interviews with people about the concept of accountability and with framing essays and sort of thinking about some of the evolution of concepts around intra-movement harm over the last few decades. And a couple of copies of Parapraxis, which you can no longer buy online because it's sold out, but I'll be selling them afterwards, the few I have. So thank you so much for that beautiful introduction from Sophie and reading from their incredible book. This is just a tremendous honor to be here for a number of reasons. One, the importance of socialism and the incredible work that goes into the conference every year, but also because this particular panel, Aman and Sophie, are both thinkers on family abolition and writers of tremendous sophistication and importance and breadth and revolutionary fervor. Aman and I wrote a novel together, and it has a lot of family abolition themes woven throughout that Aman wrote into it. So I'm very excited to be here. So I'm going to be reading the first few pages, 7 pages of my book. I've tried a few different approaches talking about family abolition on the book tour, and I found this is the one that seems to work best. So please forgive me for reading. And afterwards, I'll invite Aman to speak and ask questions. Sophie will ask questions, and then hopefully we'll have plenty of time for audience questions. In June 2006, 3,000 police officers attacked a teachers' protest in the Mexican city of Oaxaca. The teachers had been on strike for a month, occupying the central square of the city. The police and teachers battled for hours over the course of the day, leading to over 100 hospitalizations. In the aftermath of the confrontation, hundreds of social movement organizations gathered to form the Asamblea Popular de los Pueblos de Oaxaca, or APO, an organization that became the central coordinating body of hundreds of protests and occupations over the coming 7 months. In August, insurgent women seized control of multiple radio stations, going on to use them as communication hubs for the movement. At the end of one radio broadcast of an occupied station, the newscaster concluded, "Transmitting from the Oaxaca Commune." Insurgents took up the name, referencing the Paris Commune of 1871. The militants of the Oaxaca Commune erected hundreds of barricades throughout the city. They used the barricades to defend their neighborhoods against nightly attacks by police and paramilitaries. Many workers were on strike, living full-time at the barricades. Many not on strike spent their nights on the barricades after the day's work was done. Insurgents communicated with each other over the radio from one barricade to the next and began to identify themselves by the name of their barricade. These barricades became sites of what I call insurgent social reproduction, the transformation of the daily tasks of household labor into means of sustaining militant protest. Brewcapeller writes, "The barricades were places where the people of Oaxaca slept, cooked and shared food, had sex, shared news, and came together at the end of the day. Women on the barricades redistributed seized goods, conducted educational workshops, gathered supplies, socialized together, and shared life." Peller goes on, "People belonged to the commune simply because they took part in the reproduction of daily life. From cooking at the barricades, carrying coffee to the barricades from homes and businesses, carrying news between barricades, to making Molotovs at barricades, stacking rocks, or simply sharing stories. The women of the Oaxaca commune were engaged in a moment of family abolition. They were rebelling simultaneously against both abusive husbands and racist anti-Indigenous and anti-worker state forces. They were challenging the social role to which they were relegated as women, as wives, as mothers, upending norms of gender and sexuality. Their collective labor made the rebellion possible. Rather than the atomized isolation of private households, during the rebellion, people lived collectively on the barricades. What had been the women's work in the home became the daily practice of reproducing the insurrection. Through the barricades, the women of the Oaxaca commune created a new collective life that overcame the divisions between public and private. They were refusing the private household as a link in the circuits of racial capitalism. For these women, rejection of the family was not a move toward isolation or abandoning of caretaking relationships. They brought their children with them to the barricades. They were not simply rejecting maternal caretaking, but radically transforming it. They were expanding the care labor of their private homes into a mass insurrectionary movement for the transformation of society as a whole. In creating the collective life of the barricades, they were constituting a new basis for shared social reproduction and shared intimacy. They were transforming the isolation of domestic life into a means of communal revolutionary survival. The women of the Oaxaca commune rebelled against a system of private households, male-dominated kinship arrangements, and a gendered division of labor. All these are dimensions of the family form that characterize most people's lives under racial capitalism. Families typically exist as private households in segmented isolation from each other, divided by architecture, resources, public policy, and custom. Each family works separately, helping to reproduce capitalist society from one generation to the next. Families raise children and offer them their first socialization in heteronormative gender norms and labor market discipline. Through maintaining a stable family, individuals gain legitimacy, social acceptance, and respectability. People's kinship arrangements and households are judged by the extent to which they manage to obtain an ideal of the family rooted in a long history of white supremacy and capitalism. Through the Oaxaca commune, women sought to overcome the family form. Their efforts, in turn, made the scale of the mobilization possible. Many popular rebellions today share this quality. When large numbers of working class people move into open rebellion, the boundaries of the family begin to break down. The private household gives way to the collective life of shared insurgent social reproduction. Those subjugated within the private family may seize the opportunities for new ways of living and loving together. Rather than rigid gender norms, people may begin to care for each other as comrades. replacing private family kitchens or takeout from local restaurants, people may gather around protest kitchens, canteens, and group meals. Care for children, the injured, and others unable to work because it becomes a shared concern of collective projects of survival. Family abolition is a horizon of human freedom, one briefly visible on the barricades of the Oaxaca commune. The family is a limit to human emancipation. The family's horrors are vast, its abuses widespread, its logic coercive. The family is a joy for some, a necessity for most, and a nightmare for far too many. Behind its closed doors, the household is a gamble. Children born into abusive households have no recourse from harmful parents. Those trapped in abusive couple relationships may see their means of escape gradually cut off by manipulative and controlling partners. Those working-class adults who wish to be part of a child's life are forced into further degrees of economic precarity to keep their children fed and cared for, trapping parents further into awful jobs. The family policing system targets poor, Black, Indigenous, and migrant families with new forms of state violence in the name of protecting children, leaving the violence of the white property family form untouched. The family is also a limit to our imagination. Many of us grow up in private households and struggle to envision anything else. We can barely conceive of real alternatives to the family. Shared households are often a necessary survival strategy for proletarians, yet most working class families come under frequent pressure from changing labor market conditions, state policies, or state violence. These pressures make it hard to form and hold together families. But even harder to maintain chosen, non-normative living arrangements. Many imagine and pursue a household that is entirely chosen and a radical alternative to the normative family, but attempts at holding such arrangements together often fall apart over decades of the stresses of trying to find and maintain work, to pay rent, to deal with medical emergencies, or to face aging. Others fled shared households altogether, only to find isolation and loneliness. Beyond some variation on the private household, what could possibly provide the care we all so desperately need? The family is also a limit for many mass social movements and revolutionary struggles. Social revolutions that leave untouched the tyranny of the home prevent a deeper social and cultural change that could have extended into everyone's lives. So long as the private household is maintained, no revolutionary process can overcome class society. Many reform protest movements run into major internal crises when they are forced to grapple with conflicts and contradictions often relegated to the family. Countless organizations and parties have been destroyed because they were unable to adequately address sexual assault, intimate partner violence, the unequaled gender division of labor, or the demands of child rearing. The family is a movement, and the family is a limit, and the real movement for collective liberation must abolish it. Family abolition is a fraught phrase. Right-wing critics accuse proponents of family abolition of trying to destroy gender, market relations, and civilization. Progressive opponents of the idea suggest it is an ultra-left fantasy likely to alienate people, foreclosing the mass constituency necessary for social democratic demands. Some astute skeptics of family abolition point to how Black, Indigenous, and people of color rely on family relations to survive the racist onslaught of the state. Many imagine that family abolition calls for the acceleration of the current neoliberal social forces that make having children or finding a stable home challenging for so many people. These critiques of family abolition reflect deeper anxieties. Many people rely on their family when they are at their most vulnerable, as newborns and children, while sick or disabled, while aging or approaching death. For those lucky enough to have loving family members, such support can be a great source of solace. Even those with unsupportive families of origin may keep them close throughout their lives. Those who raise us have a profound impact on our emotional, physical, and social development. Parenting, in turn, can be an extraordinary space of self-growth and experience of long-term care for another person. Unlike most relationships in a capitalist society, families can offer what feels to be an unconditional and unwavering form of love, at least sometimes. It is through the language of family that people most often articulate their yearnings for care, for affection, for the long-term interweaving of our lives. For those with cruel or harmful families, the idea of doing a better, of forming healing chosen family, can be profoundly compelling. Family abolition provokes in listeners fears of being abandoned, of being without support, of being left to face the violent, being left alone to face the violent power of the state or the cruelty of work. These are nearly universal fears in an era of neoliberal dismantling of social welfare supports, increasing atomization of capitalist society, racist state violence, and generalized instability. Many imagine family abolition as the left robbing them of their only means of solace and survival. In their imagination, to abolish the family is to make the world unlivable. Human life depends on care. We are all inescapably interdependent. In our society, many important forms of care are often concentrated in families. Everyone needs material supports. For some, these are found through a family's access to jobs or property, safe housing, financial support during difficult times, healthy food, mobility, or quality healthcare. But the basis of a rich human life also includes the emotional, interpersonal, and physical supports families provide. These are all basic human needs, and the family is where we are most likely to have found them. To those who fear family abolition, abolishing the family sounds as if it involves eliminating access to care. However, the opposite is true. Family abolition is a commitment to making the care necessary for human flourishing freely available throughout society. Rather than relying solely on one's immediate personal relationships, access to care could be built into the social fabric of our collective lives. Family abolition is the vision that the basis of thriving should not depend on who your parents happen to be, who you love, or who you choose to live with. Family abolition is a horizon of sexual and gender freedom beyond the bigotry imposed by those on whom we depend. Family abolition is the expansion of care as a universal, unconditional social good. Family abolition is not just the positive assertion of care, but also refusal of the harmful relationships of domination that the family form enables. Family abolition is a belief that no child should be trapped by cruel parents, no woman should be afraid of poverty or isolation and leaving her violent husband, no aging, disabled, or sick person should be afraid of having to depend on an indifferent and uncaring family member. Family abolition is the recognition that no human being should ever own or entirely dominate another person, even children. No individual should have the means to coerce intimacy or labor from another, as current property relations enable. Family abolition is the destruction of private households as systems of accumulating power and property at the cost of others' well-being. As well as overcoming the private household, family abolition must also be the radical overturning in how society values particular family forms at the expense of others. A long history of white supremacy, heteronormativity, and capitalist property relations have enshrined a particularly narrow vision of the family as the basis of an orderly society. Certain family norms are upheld in law, enforced through state violence, and defended in popular culture. Family abolition is a call for embracing the many forms and care of care and love through which people can form rich and fulfilling lives. It is for the destruction and overcoming of an ideal that treats some family structures as normal while devaluing or destroying other care relations. In the spirit of the Oaxaca Commune, let us advance. Thank you.
So my name is Iman. Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Michelle asked me to speak a little bit about our co-authored novel, Everything for Everyone, and the role of family abolition in our book. So as folks mentioned, the book is a speculative fiction in which we lay out a future society that transitions out of capitalism. So the conceit of the book is that we're two interviewers, we're little old ladies, we've achieved our lifelong dream of becoming little old ladies, and we are interviewing folks who in some way played a part in the revolutionary transition, and we're doing that to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the 2052 food riot that marked a shift in New York's history towards communization. And family abolition is a huge theme in the book, and Emmy at some point talked about her new book as a sort of companion book to our novel. And I think of them as the sort of fiction and nonfiction versions. This is the, like, you know, history and theory and kind of straightforward visioning, and the novel effectively takes you into a world in which the family is abolished and takes you into the lives of characters who were either involved in the transition out of the family system or grew up in the new sort of abolished family. So the world that we imagine is structured not around nuclear households. We all know that the nuclear households we live in now have enormous impact, right? On one of the characters in the book is a young person who is reading about the pre-transition past, and they realize that people in the past who you slept with, who your parents were, who you lived with, all determined, how much food you had and whether you had money for rent, whether you were going to be sheltered, your future. I know in my other hat, I'm a social scientist. And we know that we can predict people's outcomes to almost 85% accuracy in this society based on just their parents' wealth at the moment they were born, right? So this is a society that pretends to be deeply meritocratic and in which, you know, there's this huge pretense of mobility. So in the book, people are living, instead of in nuclear households, they're living in these large collective communes where you have, anywhere from 200 to 1,000 people that live regionally connected to each other and live in various units. They cook together. They make decisions together. They produce together for the world, and they consume together in the world. And so this is a world in which it doesn't actually matter who you're sleeping with or who your parents are. You will have your needs met, your material needs. We play with what that opens up in terms of the possibilities of how people love each other, right? How people form a future without the family is not a future without kinship. It's not a future without love. It's actually a future in which love is liberated from the family structure. And so we think about that a lot in the book. And I'm so glad that Emmy wrote this book or was in the process of writing this book as we were wrapping up the novel, because in the past year since it came out, that's one of the main things that folks have reacted to at events, at bookstores, speaking engagements. People are like, let's talk about these family abolition chapters. And folks are very concerned that children will be taken away from parents. People are, and I think it speaks to the degree to which we meld these two notions of family and kinship, of love and the family as an economic unit, that it's so hard to sort of imagine a future in which these are separated. We also play a lot with the gender horizons, to borrow Emmy's term, What if we imagined a family in which mothering could also happen, or gestating could be something that anyone could do, given various transformations to their body? Emmy had asked me to talk a little bit about family abolition in the novel, and so I just wanted to open that up and pull the novel into our conversation. We're excited to hear your questions. I think we're...
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.